Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books Network Seminar. Welcome and thank you very much for joining me in a conversation about a book that I love very much. This is John Durham Peter's recent book, The Marvelous Clouds, Toward a Philosophy of Elemental Media. This came out in 2015 with the Chicago University Press. Now, what are elemental media, you might ask? Well, you're going to hear a lot about that in the hour to come, but they include, for example, fiery media, watery media, airy media, earthy media, and ethery media. Over the course of the book, what John does is he brings us into these environments as media, as a way not just to inform and push on and speak to and speak from media studies, but also as a way to help us see different kinds of things and ask different kinds of questions than we might otherwise be able to. What would it mean to really take seriously the question of whether clouds have meaning? What would it be to live in an ocean habitat as a human being? What would that do to how we understand and experience not just sensation, vision, hearing, but also some of the basic fundamental elements of our human infrastructure that we take for granted, like the idea of now, for example. And you'll hear us talk about that in a few moments. So it's a book that is absolutely beautiful. It's really, really thoughtful, and it's full of so many just wonderful questions and conversations and narratives and ways of thinking about what it is to be a human being, what it is to be living in, living with, living on, living through something, and how we might bring together the humanities, the arts, the sciences, media studies, and natural studies to have a kind of conversation that might really push us in new directions, and a conversation for which the stakes are really, really high. So this is a book that's not just about, at least in terms of my reading of it, it's not just about let's have thought experiments for their own sake. It's a book that really shows why those thoughts and why this kind of thoughtfulness about this particular set of topics is urgent, is vital, is important, is necessary. So thank you so much for joining us at the channel. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoy. It's a beautiful book, and I had a lot of fun talking with John about it. So thanks again. Enjoy and get your hands on a copy of the book when you have a chance. It's super worth it, and it rewards close reading, no matter who you are and what field you are and what you're interested in. Enjoy. I'm here today to talk with John Durham Peters about his new book, The Marvelous Clouds, and a marvelous book it is. Welcome to the New Books Network Seminar, John, and thanks so much for making time to talk with me today.
My pleasure.
So this is an amazing book, and we have a lot to talk about, but let's start at the beginning. John, how did you come to work in communications studies as your major field?
That's kind of a long story that I'll try not to get bogged down in, but I've always been interested in deep questions about life and the universe. I can remember when I was very young asking my mother where God came from, and she said, "Well, Mother Nature." She was a good feminist, and so I think she and she was an artist, asked me lots of good questions when I was little. My father was a doctor interested in science. And so I think I was raised in an environment where big questions were kind of natural things to pursue. And I couldn't figure out what to major in college. And I decided on an English major because it seemed to integrate a lot of my interests. And then I was called to serve a church mission in the Netherlands after my sophomore year in college. And I spent 2 years there in Holland in a variety of cities. And I met people from all over the world and learned Dutch and learned bits of other languages and was kind of thrown into the Indo-European cauldron and realized, you know, English doesn't really, you know, cover all the problems of meaning and symbol making that I'm interested in. And, you know, one day after my mission, I was in the University of Utah bookstore and happened upon a bunch of books on the on the shelf for a class that were basically all the books that I wanted to read. And it was a communication studies class. And so it was serendipity. It was happenstance. I ended up taking the class and switched to a master's in communication and then got my PhD. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, the field that I dreamed it would be when I started in, but it's certainly given me a lot more room to look at language and meaning and culture and history and technology and all the stuff that I'm interested in. So sorry for the long answer, but
no,
there it is.
Ah, bookstores.
Bookstores.
Take a moment to appreciate bookstores. I went to university as well, and there was always a week at the beginning of classes where you'd go into the bookstore, and at that point, all the classes' books were on all the shelves, and it was just this carnival of ideas, and it was perfect.
Carnival, yes. Carnival. That's what it is.
So how did you come from this broader field to this particular project on elemental media? And related to that, at what point did you decide that elemental media would sustain for you a book-length object, a book-length project?
Yeah, I mean, elemental media, I'm not sure if that term was early or late in the process of writing. A term that I really liked early on was infrastructures and infrastructural media. And the marketing people at the University of Chicago told me that infrastructural were the kiss of death. And I think, speaking of bookstores, I think they were right, actually. And, you know, the book really is structured to try to hit upon, you know, the five classical elements of water and fire and air and earth and ether. And so I realized that actually the marketers gave me a gift of helping me to rethink of a more fundamental and a better term, because elemental has the deep philosophical history. It's also got a nice kind of natural science feel to it, you know, earth elements, things. And it also kind of has this, you know, phenomenological sense of something which is in the background and taken for granted, the basic elements of life. So I guess, I mean, that too is a kind of serendipitous discovery that elements could be the sustaining thread for something that I'd been trying to work on without realizing it.
So the book itself, which gets its title actually from a prose poem by Baudelaire, and this is a poem that's invoked at the very end of the book, offers a philosophy of elemental media. And we've talked a little bit about already very briefly what that means, and we'll go into it in much more detail with much more kind of particularity in the course of the conversation. Now, you call media early in the book vessels and environments, containers of possibility, and we'll talk about containers and the importance of containers, right? That anchor our existence and make what we're doing possible. So not only containers, but anchors are going to be important insofar as we're going to talk about ships, right, and vessels soon.
Yeah.
So if this is what media, or at least one way of thinking media, right?
Yes.
How do environments become media? So one of the points that comes up very early in the book is that environments are media. Can you talk for listeners who may not be familiar with the book yet or may not have had a chance to pick it up a little bit about what that means for you and why that's important?
Sure. Well, I mean, since you're sitting in Canada, my book is influenced by a number of people, but including some Canadian thinkers, including Marshall McLuhan. And McLuhan liked to make the argument that media are environments and that, you know, that we live in an electronic environment or a print environment. And, you know, he was very eager to kind of pick up on the ecological metaphor of a kind of background system that enables our life and yet which we don't recognize. And, you know, in some ways, I mean, that made a lot of sense, and it still makes a lot of sense. But I thought, what would happen if we flip that and thought about, you know, the sea as a medium, or the air as a medium, or the earth as a medium? And the argument is basically that in a world in which humans have so dominated everything about nature that we can't really talk about nature in any kind of pure or, you know, untampered with conditions, so that the only access we have to the sea or to the sky or to the earth is via, media which we humans have made. And, you know, I'm not sure that every period in history that the environment would be a medium, but certainly in our day of big data and of the Anthropocene, as it's popular to call it, I think it's very useful to try to think about that the basic structures of our world as if they were media that connect us, and which our channels, and which open up different possibilities.
You call early in the book media ensembles of natural element and human craft, and that's going to be something that we're going to return to, I'm sure, implicitly or explicitly in the course of the conversation. So the chapters look at the ways that media give new life to old practices, as you put it. The practices include navigating, cultivating, stargazing, weather forecasting, documenting, fishing, among others. They look at key metaphors for digital media and more: fire, sea, clouds, sky, God, books. And they treat particulars as ways of getting at this. So we learn about the jaws of dolphins. We learn about towers and clocks and watches and particular ways of forming calendars. It's very much a book about particulars, right? Or that uses particulars as ways of engaging this. And that's really important. Ashes, soot, etc. So let's actually get right into it. Chapter one takes us into some of the foundational ideas that shape the book. And really, this chapter charts what you call a kind of intellectual landscape for rethinking media. Now, we could spend easily like 3 or 4 hours just on this chapter. There's so many thinkers and so many ideas that are so interesting here. And it's a really useful chapter for grounding us in this field. But I want to just ask you to talk about one or two of these ideas that come up that seem really, really important just for us to understand right at the beginning. And the first thing that I want to ask you about is an idea you've already mentioned. This is the idea of infrastructure. You talk about infrastructure right at the beginning as something that's absolutely crucial for the work that the book is doing. You talk about infrastructuralism as one way of possibly thinking through these ideas. And you describe infrastructural media as media that stand under, right? So if the chapter is called Understanding Media, this idea of behind the scenes, standing under, demurring is really important. So for listeners, again, who are not really familiar with the importance of this concept, out of the context of city planning or such, can you talk for us about what you take to be the most important aspects of infrastructure and the idea of infrastructuralism for us to understand in order to understand what's going to be happening in the rest of the book?
Yeah. So Understanding Media, the title, of course, is borrowed from McLuhan's book from 51 years ago, in which he unfurled so many different kinds of media as media, including light bulbs and bicycles. And my critics have said the same thing, that I tend to stretch the notion of media beyond the breaking point. But I try to reply by talking about how this notion of infrastructure, which has become so important around the world, and talking about critical infrastructure. I mean, typically we think of infrastructure as railroads and pipes and electrical grids and the internet. Hillary Clinton dubbed it the iconic infrastructure of our age, all of these things. And if we can think of media as infrastructures, I mean, rather than thinking of them as ways that, let me back up. I mean, normally we think of media as ways that stories are told or information is dispersed or advertising or news is spread. We think of radio, TV, newspapers. And my effort is to try to say, well, what would happen if we focus less upon the message, upon the content that these media carry, and more about the ways that they connect and enable? And if we did that, we would be able to see that media can be understood in a much broader way to connect with the very ground of our existence. So we can think of an electrical grid as a medium. We can think of the sea as a medium. We can think of oxygen as a medium, because it's something which is taken for granted, but which upon which everything else is built. So it's kind of an effort to move from the figure to the ground, from what's obvious to what's in the background, and to kind of celebrate what we take for granted. And just one more comment, the idea of infrastructuralism, it's really jokey in a lot of ways, because, you know, academics love to come up with isms and then trot them out to the academic marketplace and let them have scrimmages with each other. And I'm really not interested in trying to promote or produce another ism that's going to do battle with all the other isms. But it was just kind of a tongue-in-cheek, ironic thing to say, well, after structuralism, after post-structuralism, what's next? Well, how about infrastructuralism?
And that's actually one of the things I really love about the book. It's and this comes out in the writing style, but also in the way that you're leading us into these ideas. It's very playful, and it's much more sparkling and beautiful as a result of that. It opens up, and it asks us to open out into rather than closing down, and that's a really beautiful gift to give to a reader.
Thank you.
And so let's actually keep going along those lines, because the first chapter, or actually the second chapter of the book, the first one after the understanding media kind of overview, does this in a really exciting way. Chapter 2 looks at sea media. So this is going to be the first of a series of these elemental investigations. This conducts a thought experiment with two animals, right, who have, as you put it, mastered the sea in very different ways. Cetaceans and dolphins in particular play an important role here, and humans. So in taking us into the sea, one of the things that this thought experiment does is try to imagine what it is to live in the sea as a medium, as a habitat, and as an environment. So before we kind of get there specifically, let's take a little bit of a detour to talk about a concept that comes up in this context that's actually seems pretty important to what's going on. And that's the idea of media being species-specific and habitat-specific.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit to that issue?
Yes. Well, the sea is not a natural environment for humans. In fact, it's a profoundly hostile environment. And it's sort of like the other of, I mean, it's an environment that humans historically have not managed to live in very well. And, you know, one of the reasons why I like thinking about how humans were able to use ships and a variety of technology in the wake of ships to live at sea is because it's also a kind of parable for how humans have learned to live in another inhospitable environment, which is called the Earth. Because, you know, in fact, we cannot live on Earth without clothing. I mean, I would get horrendously sunburned and would not be able to live. I mean, I could not live where I live in at the 42nd latitude in the middle of North America and be able to survive outside. So, I mean, this, I'm sure we'll come back to this, but that technicity or the ability to alter our environment with media of our own making is essential to what it means to be a human being. And so the sea is profoundly unnatural for us. And it kind of brings out the more general fact that when we go to sea, we have to use craft of various kinds, just as when we live in any environment, we have to use craft. Whereas dolphin have the privilege, thanks to their very different history of evolution, of living at sea, as it were, naturally, without any kind of infrastructure, engineering. I mean, they have to breathe. I mean, there are probably all kinds of cultural techniques that they have to use to survive at sea, but their bodies are suited for that environment in a way that ours are not.
That's right. And this is this becomes really, really important, right? And we're going to talk a little bit, or I hope we'll talk a little bit as we move into the book, about the importance of bodies and body parts.
Yes.
For this, you know, feet.
Bodies. And, yes.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that bodies do in these environments is they perceive. They perceive sensations. And this becomes really interesting as part of the thought experiment. You describe the marine habitat here. And you describe or point out the fact that this environment filters out light and enables sound. And one of the really interesting things this chapter does is it really kind of holds our hand and takes us through the consequences of this. Like, let's slow down. Let's not just think of the sea in generalities. Let's really think of the particularities, the materialities and immaterialities of what it would be, right? So let's, can you say a little bit about that, just to bring listeners into kind of a moment that might give them an example of the kind of work that the book does? What are the consequences of an environment like the sea that filters out light and enables sound
for you? Yes, thank you. I don't know. I really love music, and I'd like to understand how music operates, because, you know, there are a lot of great arts that human beings have made: painting and literature and cooking and, you know, sport and all kinds of other things. But it always seems to me that music is the one that moves us the most. And music is very tricky because it comes through the ears, not through the eyes, and because it exists in time. And lots of philosophers have kind of embraced music or time or the ears as being kind of the royal road to understand what it means to exist. And so, you know, this thought experiment of imagining intelligent animals living in the marine habitat, like cetaceans in general or dolphins in particular, gives me a way to try to think about what it means to live in time. You know, if we were to relate to the universe more entirely with our ears than with our eyes, what it would be like. And, you know, we have a great example with dolphins, who may be able to do kind of interpersonal radiology because of sonar. You know, they may not need to go up to each other and say, "Hi, how are you?" They can just do, you know, ultrasounds of each other and discover what they had for lunch, or if they have a cold, or whether they're pregnant, or whether they have arthritis or whatever. I mean, what would it be like in a world in which, you know, the surface of our body was not the, you know, the impermeability of the body, of, you know, the opacity of the skin were not the condition of everyday communication. And so, you know, dolphins allow us to try to think what it'd be like to live in a world in which, you know, we couldn't sleep. We just couldn't tune out. We could sleep one, you know, brain hemisphere at a time, but we'd always have to be vigilant because of breathing. And you just can't automate your breathing when you're a mammal in the ocean. And there also, it would be no storage living in the ocean, because there's no means of writing or fire, as far as we can tell. So the question is, what kinds of data networks or memory practices would these smart animals have developed in thousands of years, I mean, millions of years of living in the sea? Would it be a kind of, you know, radically other kind of internet that the dolphins would have? I mean, I obviously don't have an answer to that, but it's very interesting to try to think about completely other ways of being in the world. I mean, the great question of phenomenology.
Great. Now, this chapter really asks us to, and along the lines of what you've been saying, it really asks us to take seriously the fact that mind is radically embodied, right? And so the minds of dolphins can't be like ours. They create with their bodies, not their hands. They communicate without artifacts, right? They could have techniques, as you put it here, but not technologies.
Right.
They do not have our infrastructures. And in terms of just coming back to the importance of this idea of infrastructure, that which we take for granted, that which stands under, that includes some of the things that you've actually mentioned, but that listeners may not have keyed into as being really important here. Time, right? Part of those infrastructures include things as basic and taken for granted as the idea of now.
Yes.
So
thank you for catching that. That's one of my favorite parts of the book.
Can you talk about that then? Now?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, what would it mean to live in a universe in which the now is not the same for all participants in the universe? Well, in fact, that is the universe that we live in. And that's what Einstein discovered clearly, is that, you know, in a really big universe, that there is no such thing as a kind of blanket now that everybody can live in. I mean, someone living light years away, there's no way to have you know, an exact clock that's going to be shared between us and them, because of the time it takes for the signal saying what time it is on Earth to reach, you know, someone in some distant galaxy. And this is actually also the same for people or animals or smart creatures living in the ocean, because, you know, they would live in a world in which you couldn't have standard time, essentially. And so I do a couple of strange little calculations to imagine what it'd be like for dolphins spread out in the sea to all engage in a common conversation. And it turns out that you can actually show that dolphins in different places might receive bits of the conversation in a different order, depending on where they're sitting. And you think, oh, this is totally bizarre. What would it be like to live in a world in which there is no such thing as a shared now? But in fact, that is the world that we live in. I walk into a library, I pick up a book by Shakespeare that was, you know, written 410 years ago, and it's shelved next to a book written by some English professor written 2 years ago. You know, a library is a place where we have all these overlapping nows, just like, you know, the night sky is a bunch of overlapping nows, because all those stars look like they're hit. I mean, they all hit, the light hits your retina at the same time, but, you know, some of those stars may not even exist now, if we can say that. I mean, that's the problem, because they may have ceased. I mean, this is hard to kind of think through, but the light that hits my retina could have been sent, you know, 50 million years ago, and the star in the meantime could have ceased to exist, but I wouldn't know it because it takes that long for the light to get here. So this kind of meditation, and maybe I'm geeking out a little bit on it, but really helps us think about what it means to live in a world of extended space and time. And that's what we live in a world that has media of recording and transmission.
And in geeking out, you're among friends here.
Yes,
if you can't geek out here, where can we geek out? So another thing that you mentioned in your discussion just now about the sea and dolphins also brings us into what I took to be another really important theme throughout the book, and something that will kind of lead us into the next chapter. That's the idea of storage, but storage related to death in particular.
And yeah.
You make a point here in this chapter that cetaceans can't bury their dead or make lasting grave sites. So this becomes really important, and it's a theme that recurs in the next chapter, this idea of settlement and graves and death.
You're an excellent reader. Thank you.
Oh, well, it's a great book. I mean, it really, like I said, it's just such a beautiful book. It makes you want to read closely. So this takes us into the second elemental medium, and this is the chapter on fire. Chapter 3 looks at fire media, and since we're already there, we're already at death, can you maybe kind of open up this medium for us a little bit by talking about the importance of death, graves, soot, in the context of fire, insofar as you find it interesting and important?
Yes, thank you. I mean, I think one of the big themes of the book is disappearance. And how do we make peace as human beings with disappearance? And of course, this is a kind of fundamental moral dilemma of being a human, is trying to figure out what it means that we're all mortal and that we're all going to die. And one of the great things that storage media have enabled for us is the ability to make monuments, memorials, and texts and libraries in ways that we can communicate across generations, sometimes at great distance. You know, these are all you know, wonderful things which define us as humans. And in a sense, what civilization is a great kind of tomb or pyramid that we build up to fight off the fact that we're all going to die, because hopefully the library won't die. And the University of Iowa has been around for 165 years or something like that. And obviously no human has survived that. But, you know, we build all these mausolea, you know, all these institutions and monuments, which allow us to transcend the sentence of death, which is, and this is why fire is so interesting, because fire is a very mysterious, utterly fascinating entity, which, you know, makes things disappear. You know, and why is it that this thing, which is so violent and so destructive and so scary, turns out to also be the best friend that human technology and art and craft has ever had. And so fire ends up being a kind of example for me of how the recognition of transience or disappearance, when brought into a cultural frame, allows us to cope. And I mean, you know, paradoxically, fire, by making things disappear, also allows us to build things. I mean, without fire, iron can become steel. And almost every technology, including the technology that you and I are now using to talk back and forth, depends upon on the refinement of the earth by fire, including, tragically, of course, on rare earth metals that infest our bloody computers from Congo and other places.
Now, this chapter takes us on, you know, there's a lot of really wonderful discussion of negation and erasure and disappearance. But as you mentioned, there's also a reminder that this is also a medium of cultivation, right? You talk about the domestication of plants, of animals, I mean, really of people, and civilization is another important theme that goes, that runs throughout the book. So I want to ask you about something very specific that also comes up in this chapter, because it recurs throughout, and it seems that the to me, at least as a reader, the fact that this recurs throughout the book might signal that it's maybe an important touchstone for you. I don't know. So either way, it would be interesting to hear about it. And that's Melville and Moby Dick.
Oh, yes.
Can you speak to that a little bit for you? Was that a touchstone in the book? And what's the importance of that particular work in terms of the work that you're doing here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, this book is an effort to write another Moby Dick. You know, it obviously isn't, and I wouldn't pretend that it is. But in some ways, the fantasy that I had is this book would be a cross between Heidegger's Being in Time and Melville's Moby Dick, maybe with Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition stirred in. So, I mean, kind of grandiosely over the top in terms of my ambition. But, you know, Moby Dick is obviously a book about craft, and it's a book about survival in a hostile element. It's a book about nature and humanity. It's a book about theology, and it's a book about the planet, and the writing is so beautiful. And so, you know, there are a lot of different angles that Moby Dick was an inspiration to me in this.
Moby Dick is the book that in North American high schools or grammar schools, at least, right? All of us read it in high school, and we're not in any kind of a position to appreciate Moby Dick as high school students. So you read it and you're like, oh, that sucks. Like, that's so boring.
Yeah, it's a bad
thing. And you have that memory in your mind of like Moby Dick equals sucks, right? Or like super boring or whatever. And then you come back to it as an adult, and it's a completely new experience. And it's just kind of world rocking if you actually bring yourself back to that work and experience it anew.
Yeah, I mean, my first book actually has some Moby Dick touches in the end. I've got a little set of quotations at the end collected by a sub librarian. So I've kept up this romance with Moby Dick for quite a while, I guess.
So as we move further into the book, we move from fire, and there's a million billion things that we could talk about, right? About fire.
It's just stuffed to the gills with weird little facts, isn't it?
Well, but it's fabulous. But we could easily, you know, spend another hour talking about containers and candles and all other sorts of things. But let's get into the air a little bit. Chapter 4 and 5 look at two major kinds of sky media. You call chapter 5, chapter 5 looks at Chronos, and chapter 4, rather, looks at Chronos, and chapter 5 looks at Kairos. And so we're looking at astronomy and meteorology, okay? Time and the weather. These are fabulous, fascinating chapters, and let's get into them at least a little bit. So in chapter 4, you bring us into a kind of way of thinking about the sky as a medium for thinking with producing and in inhabiting and embodying time. And this comes up in any number of specific objects and instances. You talk about calendars and clocks, bio calendars. There's so much we could talk about here. What I want to start with is another taken for granted object, like the now, right, which we've talked about, that this unearths. So it shines a light on an infrastructural element of time we might not otherwise see, and that's the idea of a day.
Mm.
So can you talk about the idea of a day? For you in this context, how is that important? Why is that important? And feel free to just kind of bring in whatever else you think is most important here in this chapter.
Yeah. Well, you very nicely quoted earlier my argument that a medium is an ensemble between natural elements and cultural practices. And the day is kind of the perfect example of that because, you know, clearly, you know, the earth spins on its axis. And there's a kind of natural given fact, which is pretty regular and which we can more or less depend on. And on the other hand, when you look at how different cultures and different historical moments have defined the day, it turns out to be this kind of enormous, fascinating logistical mess of, you know, should the day start at noon? Should the day start at sunset? Should it start at sunrise? Should it start at some abstract thing as ours does, such as midnight? And it turns out that the effort to define the day turns out to be this very complicated political thing in which you have, you know, the French Revolution wanting to have 10 days in the week and the Russian Revolution wanting to have 5 days in the week. And sometimes the church is involved and sometimes the state's involved and sometimes the military's involved. And sometimes in some cultures, Wednesday is called Mittwoch, I mean, as a German, middle of the week, or Sredu, and in a Russian, you know, middle. And it's just, I mean, it's, to me, it's just a kind of fascinating example of this kind of bizarre hybrid of nature and culture.
Mm-hmm. So this chapter also not just kind of shines a light on now, but also talks in really, really interesting ways about the importance of directionality and orientation. And this is another set of concepts that we probably take for granted, or a lot of people probably take this for granted. And this came up, incidentally, in the sea chapter when you were talking about water and in terms of, you know, what would in a marine environment, living in that kind of environment, what would up and down mean, right? I mean, how do we think about that?
Yeah.
For you, what's most important about kind of looking anew or looking again at orientation in this context and in this way?
Yeah, well, I mean, orientation is one of those things which sounds very, very mundane, like finding directions, but it's a term that also has a kind of deep emotional, ethical, or religious meaning to it. I mean, to be oriented, to know where you are in the cosmos. Of course, the term orientation comes from East, Orient, knowing where East is. I mean, this room that I'm sitting in is perfectly aligned with the heavens. And it's because I live in a place that was explored in the 19th century and which was laid out upon a grid. I'm more or less facing exact or true north. And, you know, this is a kind of invisible fact that, you know, throughout a lot of, you know, places in North America, I doubt you can do this in Vancouver. I mean, waterfront property doesn't allow for, you know, grids as easily, but we are kind of, you know, our walls, the directions that we sleep in, you know, how we drive, how we walk around are defined by our orientation to the cosmos in a way that, for example, dolphins, because their eyes are too poor to actually see it, could not take the stars into account as a kind of basis for their architecture and city planning and so on. And I've got some weird stuff in there that I really don't know what to do with, but some brainwave research suggesting that people may actually sleep better pointing in different directions, or that there may be some kind of inherent, you know, orientation in the human brain. We know that bird brains do this. I mean, we make fun of bird brains for being stupid, but birds know how to, you know, how to orient with regard to the sun. Bees know how to do this. I mean, maybe there's something in the human brain that there's a kind of vestigial connection to, you know, the ways that our, you know, that our Earth rotates, the way that it happens to be spinning.
One of these days, we're going to have a whole other conversation about prepositions in this context. I'm going to kind of budget time with you. We need to talk about that. Not right now, necessarily.
Prepositions. But, I love prepositions.
Oh, I'm writing about this. We'll talk. We'll talk. We'll have coffee talk.
You know, Michelle Serre, people keep telling me I need to read Michelle Serre, French philosopher, historian of science, who has a lot to say about prepositions, but anyway, great.
We'll talk.
For the next time.
But for this time, let's get back to now, and we get back to now and the idea of now in the next chapter. So chapter 5, The Times and the Seasons, Sky Media 2, takes us into weather. And we have so many amazing points of reference and objects that we could talk about here. Watches. You call watches a counter, a pointer, a stargazer, a body technique, a pet. There are towers which allow us to understand a notion of leverage, and maybe we'll get back to that if we have time. We have the object of Heidegger as a weatherman here, which is fascinating. We have bells. We have sound marking space. It's just full of amazing specificity and amazing particulars. But one in particular we have to talk about because it's perhaps an idea that might bring people to the book in the first place. It's in the title, and it's really important. And this is the cloud. So you talk about clouds here in this chapter, and you talk about clouds and say you talk about the idea that clouds could be media as a kind of, as you put it, test of the limits of the concept. So calling clouds media is a test of the limits of the concept of media. So can you talk about that, John?
Sure. Well, this happened in one of my seminars in which we were talking about what the media concept means. And I had proposed a probably fairly outlandish list of potential candidates for what counts as media. And I had this brave, thoughtful student who said, "Are clouds media?" And I was stumped because, you know, clouds end up, you know, showing up in conversations like this as kind of the ultimate, you know, nonsensical thing, the one thing that we can never claim has any meaning to it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it's kind of absurd to say that clouds don't mean anything. I mean, tell that to a farmer or a sailor or a pilot or a meteorologist or a painter. It's clear that clouds mean all kinds of things, and particularly, you know, in the 20th century when we have to live with the poison gas cloud from World War I or the mushroom cloud of World War II or the cloud of, you know, particulate carbon floating, you know, 400 parts per million of carbon floating around in our atmosphere at the moment. So to say that different kinds of clouds are things that we shouldn't read, or that there's something wrong with reading them as meaningful, as media, as conditions for our world, I think is a kind of, you know, hazardous. I mean, it's hazardous for us to say clouds don't mean anything in the world that we happen to live in.
You actually talk about, you use the word urgency, right?
Yeah.
It's urgent to look for images in the clouds, to read the clouds. Can you talk more about that urgency?
Sure. Well, I mean, just kind of what I'm fighting against, there's 2,000 or 3,000 years of history saying that clouds are fluffy and silly and subjective. You get it in Aristophanes. You get it in the Bible as well. But in terms of kind of, you know, the looming apocalypse that our age has to worry about, it's clearly that of climate change. And, you know, I wrote an essay, which is going to come out a little bit in a little bit, about 1964 as a great year of technological thinking. And I discovered that they were equally worried about an apocalypse in the sky, which of course is a thermonuclear apocalypse, which would be more sudden. You know, we tend to be worried about a more longer term kind of end to life as we know it, but it would also come from the sky. If our weather patterns get messed up, if the polar ice cap melts, if the albedo, if the, the reflective power of all the polar ice stops bouncing the heat back up into the sky and we start absorbing it in our oceans, the seas will rise, the cities will go under. A lot of what we take for granted about habitability will be impossible. The amount of food that we can grow because of the, Haber-Bosch process of, of using, nitrogen to produce fertilizer to, grow green revolution plants. I mean, we are radically dependent upon a series of conditions that we take for granted. And if we take them for granted, we put our survival at risk. That's the urgency.
Now, you raise a question here in this chapter that also comes up right in the introduction, I think, and this is the question of meaning, right? What would it look like and what would it be to ask if clouds have meaning? And you actually help us understand meaning in a different way by asking that question and asking us to consider that question, right? And I think in the introduction, you mention this. I think you say that meaning is repositories of readable data and processes that sustain and enable existence. This is a really different way of thinking about meaning than many readers to the book with. So do you want to talk a little bit about
that? Sure. Well, that, I don't mean in that quote you just read, I don't mean to say that that is exactly what meaning is, but that those things yield meanings and need to be seen as legitimate sources for finding meanings. As an English major in the 1970s, my teachers taught me with a kind of a lot of pathos that we lived in this world of overweening technology and science that was objectifying and cruel and calculating, and that we needed to go to art and poetry in order to find meaning. And I love art and poetry, and don't get me wrong, but it seemed to me kind of dangerous to end up locating meaning only in the only in the world of human creation and only in the world of canonized human creation, like poetry or art or cuisine or whatever. I mean, it seems like it's really dangerous to say that the clouds don't have meaning or that the oceans don't have meaning or that the stars don't. When I say meaning, it doesn't mean that the stars have intentionally decided that they're going to send us some kind of cryptic message, but rather that there's significance built into their very existence, and that it's our option and responsibility and great gift as media theorists to read those meanings which were never written or never intended, the result of a individual's psychology. I mean, the clouds don't have psychology, but they have meaning. So I'm interested in trying to think about how we would think about meaning that is not rooted in brains, but is still there. Because I think the world is full of it, full of abundant meaning that we should be reading and thinking about.
And the conclusion of the book is we're not there yet, but we'll get there. And the conclusion
I'm pushing you ahead.
No, this is great. I just want to kind of signal for listeners that the conclusion of the book really takes on this idea and that kind of uses it to propose the need for what you call a greener media studies, and really talks about the stakes involved, right? I mean, this is important, again, a sense of urgency goes along with this idea of the stakes of taking nature seriously as a kind of epitome of, or a repository or space of meaning and media making.
Yes.
So to get there, we need to go through Earth and ether, though. So let's briefly take a trip through there. So we've just talked about clouds. And for listeners, clouds, are not just those things in the sky. They're also, the inky kind of phantoms that squid squirt out in the water, right? So the clouds can be a lot of different sorts of things. But clouds right now, the idea of a cloud also has a very strong digital resonance, obviously, right? Which really brings us into the next chapter. This is a chapter that looks at the body and writing as earth media, as earth-related media. But it also brings us into the really the importance of the digital in a really material and immaterial kind of a way. So after looking in this chapter at the body as medium, right, and we've already talked a little bit about this, the importance of faces and hands and feet, you You talk about the importance of, or the issue of telepresence. This is what we're doing right now.
Yes.
It's very appropriate. And the idea of presence as a medium. Now, this is for those of us who work in university environments, right, who are working in these kinds of networks, virtuality and telepresence, the kind of what comes with being in person, body to body, and what comes with not doing that, these are really vital issues right
now. Absolutely.
So can you speak a little bit to this issue of telepresence and the idea of presence as a medium in the book?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this is something that I talk a lot about with my students. You know, the undergrads are all convinced that social media has essentially destroyed their interactions with each other. And if you ask them, they'll all say that, you know, body-to-body presence is the gold standard. And I ask them, how often do they do this? And they say, very rarely. Mm-hmm. And as we push, you know, we try to figure out why they would prefer to text or prefer to use a variety of, you know, of online platforms. And the reason seems to be that, you know, body-to-body interaction is dangerous. It's, you risk embarrassment, you risk awkwardness. You don't know if your stomach's going to gurgle or if you're going to spew somebody with an errant sneeze droplet, or, I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, bizarre little funny things that happen when you're face to face. Whereas, you know, the shield of virtuality actually, you know, provides a kind of safety in which people can imagine each other, in which they don't have to deal with the kind of complexities, the ethological complexities, the kind of animal behavior complexities of a presence. In animals that get together, it's complicated. I mean, you've got to negotiate all kinds of things. And, you know, one of my little throwaway lines in this chapter is that, you know, that we'll really have telepresence when there's something called footbook, as well as Facebook, because, you know, having your feet in the same place as someone else, that's kind of, you know, the real test of if you're really there embodied or not. I don't think any Silicon Valley entrepreneur is gonna, or vulture capitalist is gonna shell out a lot of money for Footbook, but it's a possibility.
So this is one of a number of really important issues that come up in that chapter, and we're not going to have time to talk about a whole lot of other ones, but I just want to mention for listeners who might be particularly interested in this, there's a whole series of discussions here as well about writing that we won't, you know, have too much time to talk about. Writing and lists, writing and nonlinearity. Right? The idea of nonlinearity when it comes to writing. Writing is the union of two different sensory registers, the spatial order of vision and the temporal order of hearing. Now, since you've talked about the importance of music and sound for you, and time and space and the way that these media marry the two and bring a conversation about an awareness of an experience of the two into conversation, this is a really important theme throughout all of the chapters. Maybe this is a good point at which to bring in writing. So for you, Ed, can you talk about this importance of writing in terms of these different spatial and temporal sensory registers?
Sure. I mean, I hope it's not just me trying to justify my own artistic or literary or scholarly practice. But, you know, the argument really is that writing has not been superseded by filmmaking, by sound recording, by digital media, that in fact it remains the most important and most fundamental of all media, precisely because it allows us to do time axis manipulation, you know, to talk like the engineers do. But writing allows you to jump in and out of a text in the same way that you can push pause on, and that's an amazing power to be able to manipulate time. And of course, writing is connected with the grave, because you engrave, you know, something, you write it down, you fix it. There's a certain kind of fixity, death-like quality to writing, but because it allows you to overcome time, there's also a certain kind of, you know, life quality. I mean, writing is very complicated. You know, the letter kills, the spirit gives life, as the old kind of classic opposition goes. But I want to argue that the letter also gives life, that writing allows us to, you know, talk across great distances of time and space and do all kinds of, you know, civilizational things we couldn't do otherwise.
Now, as we come to, you've mentioned death, this brings us really nicely into the next chapter, which is kind of the last body chapter.
Yes.
Before the conclusion, which is another chapter that asks us to consider the importance of forgetting, of loss, of death, as also creative movements, right? Sort of creative acts, but, you know, damage and loss and forgetting as being really kind of integral to what it is to remember,
right,
what it is to store, what it is to tag, what it is to search. And let's talk about Google. Let's talk about Google. So chapter 7 brings us into a discussion of Google. You introduce Borges as a potential patron saint of Google.
Yes.
And he's just really, right, the perfect figure to bring in here. And I'm just a major figure in the chapter. Now, patron saint, this language of saint, sainthood, really evokes the importance of a kind of theological reading or religious reading of Google in this chapter. And so let's talk about that, right? Because this is a really important move here. Google as a religious medium and a possibility and what we get out of a theological analysis of Google. What for you is most important about that move?
Yeah, thank you. You know, I mean, my argument is essentially that Google wants to be godlike and that it markets itself quite explicitly as a kind of total, benign, benevolent, you know, overseeing being that provides you all of your wants if you only ask it. Knock and you shall find, all this kind of stuff. Against that, I mean, if I actually try to figure out what I'm doing in the chapter, I think I'm basically giving an anti-totalitarian theological read on Google. Now, if that doesn't make sense, you know, in my religious tradition of Mormonism, God is often understood to be finite, that is, not as not being strictly omniscient or omnipotent, which is actually a good thing because it allows us to try to, it allows us to understand suffering and death in a better light, because, you know, we don't blame God for the problems of Earth because there's some ways that he cannot intervene. And so I think I'm trying to say, here's Google. It pretends to want to solve death. It claims to be the great uniter of all of our knowledge. What would happen if we really understood that Google was about disappearance and incompleteness and imperfection? And what would, you know, this is kind of the thing that I hint at but don't really develop. What would happen if we understood God as perhaps somehow implicated in an imperfect but ongoing or growing universe? That's kind of the, you know, the really big question that is lurking around in there somewhere.
It's super fascinating. So we're almost at the end of
sure.
the time, John, but I want to just kind of bring us briefly into the conclusion. And the idea of this religious or theological reading of Google kind of nicely does that. So in addition to calling for a greener media studies, right, that, as you put it here, appreciates our long natural history of shaping and being shaped by our habitats as a process of mediation, right? And we've talked already a little bit about the stakes of taking nature seriously in its relationship to meaning and meaning making. In addition to this, you gesture toward or you ask us to think about the importance of media studies being friendlier to a number of different kind of fields or disciplines, including, you know, you mentioned philosophy, you mentioned theology, but you also mentioned the natural sciences.
Yeah.
And it's this last part that I'd love to ask you to talk about a little bit, because that really gets at the heart of a lot of conversations that a lot of us are having right now. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, here again, so much of 20th century thought has pitted the two cultures against each other. And I think that's one of the most hideous ideas to ever infest academe. I don't think there are two cultures, one of science and one of humanities. I think there's maybe lots and lots of cultures, or maybe one culture. But, you know, for us to say that natural sciences are things that we shouldn't know about, or they're just dry and boring and stupid, it's just completely uninformed. I mean, if you look at what's going on in natural science, it's mind-boggling and fascinating. And natural scientists, I mean, are often the people who are least committed to the kind of positivist narrative that humanists like to blame natural scientists for having. So, I mean, this is really a call to try to, you know, be friendlier, be much more ecumenical to a lot of up toward knowledge in general. I mean, that's what media studies should be, is a kind of encyclopedic take on what we know. I mean, that's the kind of stakes, the huge ambitious stakes of the book, is that media studies should be an analysis of the human condition. And you can't look at the human condition without understanding our status as animals, as political animals, as Aristotle would say, that live in this really rich environment.
And that's a perfect note to bring us to our conclusion. John, thank you so much. Now, there's, you know, we touched on just a few moments, right, of many fabulous descriptions and objects and concepts in the book. It's just, it's a beautiful, extraordinarily rich book, and we've only just barely explored the surface.
You're so kind. Thank you.
Is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners, though, that especially perhaps for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers that we haven't talked about?
You know, I don't know if this is relevant, but sometimes I've suggested to academic readers that they read chapter one and non-academic readers that they skip chapter one. And I don't know if you would agree with this, but chapter one is really much, it's really about how this fits into ongoing debates about media theory. And I hope that the book would be able to reach people who are kind of interested in thinking about what it means to be a human and what it means to be a human at this moment on Earth. And, you know, I wouldn't want chapter one to be a barrier to entry.
I think chapter one is written in a way that's really accessible for non-academics as well. And what I would say is for listeners who are non-academics or who are just not, don't consider themselves to be maybe professionally involved in, you know, academic writing or however we want to put that, chapter one is a really great way of setting out an ecology or a landscape of other thinkers and people and works that you might want to explore to, you know, to keep exploring these ideas. So I think it depends on expectations,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Great. So now that the book is out and it's a beautiful, wonderful book that everyone should read, I'll just say that definitively. What's next for you? What are you currently working on?
Well, you know, I'm working on a lot of different things, but the main next book is going to be a co-authored book with a colleague of mine who actually died almost 10 years ago. And Ken Camille was a historian at the University of Iowa. He's a very close friend, and he started this book on kind of the cultural history of media in the U.S., focusing on how people thought about images and information. And, you know, he died suddenly and abandoned not just the book, he abandoned a lot of things. And as a work of mourning, I think I'm going to, you know, in the next year, I'm going to finally finish this strangely co-authored book with my colleague who can't actually tell me that I'm getting it wrong. So it's been a very interesting kind of, you know, ethical and personal and intellectual process to try to write something with someone who's who's gone. So I mean, maybe that explains why I'm interested in thinking about disappearance and writing and the grave and all of these things.
Thank you for taking time from that to talk with us today. It's
totally
been a pleasure. Thank you. You've been listening to the New Books Network Seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.